And then the temperature kept rising. The line was slow at first until it reached the tipping point and suddenly spiked upward. When I hit that on the board, Nathaniel stepped forward to the end of the conference table and stood with his hands clasped in front of him. The conversation quieted.
In 1824, Joseph Fourier described an effect that Alexander Bell later called the greenhouse effect. In it, particles in the air cause the atmosphere to retain heat. If the meteor had struck land, the winter would have been longer. The fireball would have been larger. We thought it was fortunate that it struck water, but it's worse. The Earth is going to come out of winter and get hotter. In 50 years, there will be no snow in North America.
The pudgy man who had complained about snow in California laughed.
Coming from Chicago, I gotta say, this doesn't strike me as a problem.
How do you feel about 100% humidity and summers with a low of 120 degrees?
Still, weathermen can't predict if it's going to rain tomorrow. 50 years is a long time out.
President Brannon raised his hand again. He was staring at me. No, at the board. I stepped to the side so he could see it better.
Dr. York, what does the upturn on that chart represent?
That is when the oceans begin to boil.
It was as if a jet engine had sucked the air out of the room. Someone said,
You can't be serious, that's...
President Brannon slapped his hand on the table.
I hope you'll grant that I know something about the planet and how it behaves. We're having this meeting because I've already looked over Dr. York's figures and consider the problem serious. We're not here, gentlemen, to debate the matter. We're here to decide what to do about it.
Thank God. Brannon was only the acting president until Congress could confirm him, which required having a Congress, which required elections, but still, all the powers of the president were currently invested in him. He surveyed the room and then gestured to Monsieur Scherzinger.
Will you take the floor? Certainly.
He stood and came to stand by Nathaniel.
Gentlemen, Mrs. York, there is a saying in Switzerland, ne pas mettre tous les œufs dans le même panier. Which you will know in English as, do not put all your eggs in one basket. The United Nations feels that, in addition to reducing the damage here on Earth, we must also look beyond our planet. It is time, gentlemen, to colonize outer space.
Part 2 10
UN urged to aid the Ukraine. Special to the National Times. Rome, February 20th, 1956. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization today urged all member governments to consider immediately what assistance they could give to the Ukraine, part of the former Soviet Union, which is threatened with famine after the failure of its crops during the meteor winters. The UN instructed its director general to continue to give, upon request of the Ukrainian government, all appropriate assistance, technical or other, that lies within his authority and competence.
Do you remember where you were when we put a man into space? I was one of two computer girls sitting in the International Aerospace Coalition's dark room at Sunflower Mission Control in Kansas, with graph paper and my mechanical pencils. We used to launch from Florida, but that was before the meteor and before the NACA became part of the IAC. Sunflower already had a rocket facility from the war, so it made sense to relocate inland, away from the wrecked coast. 3 miles away, the fruit of our labor sat on the launch pad, a Jupiter rocket with Stetson Parker strapped into a tiny pod atop 113 metric tons of propellant. Charming when he wanted to be, even I had to admit that he was a damn fine pilot. Unless we had really screwed up, he was going to be the first human into space. And if we screwed up, he'd be dead. Of the Artemis 7 astronauts, he was my least favorite, but I wanted him to survive this. The banks of instrument panels gave a soft glow to the room, and the sound dampening panels they'd added to the walls kept voices low, or as low as possible, given a room filled with 123 technicians. The air crackled with electricity. Men paced at the edges of the room. As lead engineer, poor Nathaniel was stuck in the new White House waiting with President Brannon to talk to the press. They had two speeches written, just in case. Across the small light table from me, Hugh Lang, Helen, Lou, played chess with Renard Carmouche, one of the French engineers, while we waited. Helen, the other computer girl, had joined the International Aerospace Coalition as part of the Taiwanese contingent. Apparently, she'd been a chess champion back home, which Mr. Carmouche hadn't quite grasped yet. After liftoff, she'd be in charge of extracting the numbers from the teletype and feeding them to me while I did the calculations to confirm that orbit had been attained. We'd been awake for 16 hours, but I couldn't have slept if you paid me. I really did need something to do with my hands. Myrtle had been trying to teach me to knit, but it hadn't taken. From the small raised platform at the end of the room, the launch director said,
"All positions are go for launch commit."
I breathed out. The launch sequence was familiar and terrifying by this point. But no matter how many things we'd launched, this was the first one carrying a human life. You couldn't help but think about the rockets that had exploded on the pad, or the ones that had made it into space carrying a monkey, only to return a dead creature to the ground. I didn't like Parker, but by God, he was brave. And I was deeply, intensely jealous of him. The mission director replied, "Roger, launch team, we are go for launch." Helen turned from the chess game and slid her chair closer to the teletype. I straightened the graph paper in front of me.
"Stand by for terminal countdown. We are T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, ignition."
Parker's voice crackled over the speaker with the roar of the rocket surrounding him.
"Confirm ignition."
"2, 1, and liftoff. We have liftoff."
Moments later, the thundering roar of the rocket ignition hit the room in a wave. It pulsed through my chest, even 3 miles away, even in a concrete bunker, even with sound dampening on the walls. I broke into a sweat. The only thing louder was a meteorite impact. If you were too close to the rocket during liftoff, the sound waves would literally shred you.
"Confirm liftoff. Manual clock has started."
I picked up my pencil and poised it over the graph paper.
"This is Hercules 7. The fuel is go, 1.2G, cabin pressure at 14 PSI. Oxygen is go."
As the rocket roared into the air, the teletype sprang to life with information from tracking stations across the world. Helen started circling numbers as the text came off the machine. She tore the first piece of paper free and slid it across the table. I sank into the calculations. Raw numbers told the story of position and bearing, and it was my job to use those to reveal the rocket's velocity as it left the Earth. I could see the rocket's smooth, graceful rise in my mind, but plotted the ascent on a piece of graph paper for the men standing behind me.
"Some vibrations. Sky is getting dark now."
That meant Parker was starting to exit the atmosphere. With each piece of paper Helen handed me, the line of the arc I traced continued upward within mission parameters. The roar of the rocket had faded, leaving an eerie silence. Around us, the male voices of engineers at work murmured in a quiet, intense call and response.
"Guidance, your report."
Helen read the numbers from my page, her faint Taiwanese accent coming out with her excitement.
"Velocity, 2,350 meters per second. Angle of elevation, 4 minutes of arc. Altitude, 101.98 kilometers.
Her voice was shockingly high amid the tenors and baritones of mission control. Eugene Lindholm on comm repeated the numbers to Parker. In response, he said,
"Roger, it's a lot smoother now."
The teletype rattled constantly, and Helen slid another page over to me. I held my lower lip between my teeth as my pencil flew across the page. 6,420 meters per second. The first stage engine cutoff should be soon. On the radio.
"Cutoff."
"Confirm engine cutoff."
"I can see the booster falling away."
I glanced at the clock, counting the seconds along with everyone else. Half a minute after the booster dropped away, the escape tower should jettison. He'd be well and truly on his own then.
"Tower jettison is green."
"Confirm tower jettison."
Momentum carried Parker higher, and with the next page Helen handed me, I started to smile. 8,260 meters per second. Hello, orbital velocity. but I did the calculations on the page anyway to show my work.
Periscope is coming out. Turnaround started.
Confirm turnaround.
Behind me, Mr. Carmouche asked,
"Why are you smiling?"
I shook my head and drew one more dot on the graph at 280 kilometers above the surface. Getting Parker into space was the first step. Achieving orbit required altering his trajectory, and that was all on him.
Switching to manual.
The radio continued to crackle as he left the channel open.
The view is... Wish you all could see this.
Roger. Wish for seeing view confirmed.
Didn't we all wish for that? If he orbited successfully, that got us one step closer to a space station, which got us a step closer to the moon base, and then Mars, Venus, and the rest of the solar system. Alan gave me another sheet from the teletype. I tracked Parker's position by shifts in Doppler frequency. The frequency of those waves showed the rocket's path over the Earth. I plugged the numbers into the string of calculations, and then ran through it again just to be sure. Turning in my seat, I lifted the page over my head. He made it! He's in orbit! Grown men jumped from their seats, shouting like kids at a ball game. One fellow threw paper into the air and it fluttered down around us. Someone clapped me on the shoulder and there was a sudden warm, wet pressure on my cheek. I pulled back, glaring at Mr. Carmouche, whose lips were still puckered from the kiss. We still have to get him home. I wiped my cheek off and set my pencil on the page again. Across the table, Helen met my gaze and nodded. Then she handed me the next sheet of paper. The light from the hall outside our rented apartment fell across the bed. I rolled over as Nathaniel's silhouette entered, muffled by his overcoat. The light from the bathroom reflected only on his shoes and the snow still caught in his trouser cuffs. I'm not asleep. That was mostly true. I'd left the Murphy bed down before I went to Mission Control that morning because I knew we'd both be too tired to deal with it after the launch. Congratulations.
To you as well.
He took off his overcoat and hung it on the peg by the front door. Housing prices in Kansas City had skyrocketed after President Brannon relocated the capital to the center of the country. Between that and all the refugees who needed homes, the only place we could afford, even with a government salary, was a studio apartment. Frankly, I was happy not to have much house to keep up with. I turned on the bedside lamp and sat up. You were wonderful in the press conference.
If by wonderful you mean that I deflected the idiot reporter who thinks the whole program is pointless, then yes. Yes, I was.
He shrugged, pulling on his tie.
I'd rather have been at Mission Control. I could hear you over the radio when they retrieved Parker after splashdown. And here I thought you didn't like the fellow.
How do you know it was me?
First, we've been married for 5 years. Second,
he kicked his shoes off.
You were one of two women in the room, and I don't think you were the one speaking Taiwanese.
Lee Kisi. Helen had taught me to swear, which came in handy with some of the engineers and occasionally my husband. Anyway, I'm allowed to be excited that the mission was a success, and I'm not evil. Or at least not enough to wish him dead for real. Mostly. He crossed the room and bent down to kiss me, tasting of good scotch.
Mostly evil. Yes, I can agree with... Ow! My point's proven.
Reaching up, I undid the top button of his collar. I think... The next button followed, exposing his clavicle and the top of his undershirt. It depends on how one defines evil. Nathaniel traced a finger along the neckline of my nightgown.
I am happy to entertain your definition.
Well, I reached the last button and tugged his shirt free of his trousers. For instance, let's say that one learned something during a press conference that her husband really should have told her. Nathaniel's hand paused at the strap of my nightgown.
Interesting example.
He slid the strap off and bent down to kiss my exposed shoulder.
I might need more specifics.
I inhaled, breathing in muskiness from his aftershave and the sweet earthiness of a fine cigar. For instance, the fact that they are expanding the astronaut corps and removing the test pilot requirement. With my face pressed into his hair, I found his belt by touch. The fabric beneath it was already strained out of shape. My God, I loved a successful rocket launch. Nathaniel nibbled a path from my shoulder to the base of my neck, sending warm currents down to my toes.
Let's say that expanding the astronaut corps was contingent on completion of a mission. Would withholding information about the expansion be considered evil if the motivation was to keep someone's hopes from rising?
Rising hopes. I released the zipper on his trousers, and Nathaniel's hands tightened on my upper arms.
And would that be further mitigated if, for instance, a certain briefcase contained an application? For someone who is, say, a World War II pilot, had logged the requisite flight time and fit the right height and weight requirements. Oh, God.
He cleared his throat, and his breath was hot against my neck.
I'll take that as a yes.
Confirmed. Evilness mitigated, but... I slid back on the bed, pulling my nightgown off as I did. With my arms over my head and the cool night air bringing my breasts to full attention, I also commanded my husband's full attention. It's the action one would take to protect a child. Am I a child?
God, no.
He shrugged out of his dress shirt and peeled his undershirt off. The bedside lamp caressed the curve and flex of his abdomen. After the meteor, Nathaniel had begun working out. He was not alone in that drive to be more prepared for what-if scenarios, but my heavens, did I ever appreciate the result. I threw my nightgown to the side. His gaze stayed fixed on me, and his mouth hung a little open, as if his brain were trying to acquire extra oxygen to compensate for a redirected blood flow. So, I have to ask, why wouldn't one tell an adult? I regretted the question almost immediately because this one made him pause. On the other hand, he paused in the act of sliding his trousers and underwear off in one motion so I could appreciate the V of his abdomen as it joined his pelvis and the dark hair at the base.
Because they were going to cancel the entire program, if the launch had failed.
By fail, he meant if Parker had died. Nathaniel slid his trousers the rest of the way off.
The snow. People think that the warming isn't coming, so...
I reached for him and he slid between my legs, pushing me back to lie on the bed with his warmth pressed against my full length. Wrapping one thigh around his leg, I pressed up into Nathaniel and his eyes fluttered closed. Warming is definitely coming.
Yes.
He shifted so he could reach between us. His fingers found the bright bundle of delight between my legs and, sparked my ignition sequence. Everything else could wait. Oh God, we are go for launch. 11.
IAC is spurring rocket program. 75 to 105 vehicles will be fired in 3-year schedule, Chief says. By Bill Becker, special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, March 3, 1956. The International Aerospace Coalition plans to launch 75 to 105 major rockets in the next 3 years, thereby expecting to have a colony on the moon by 1960.
Do you remember where you were when the meteor struck?
At the front of the synagogue, our rabbi looked over the congregation. I don't know about anyone else, but my eyes instantly burned with the threat of tears. Of course, I remembered. Behind me, I heard another woman sniffle. I wondered where she had been 4 years ago on March 3rd, 1952. Had she been in bed with her husband? Had she been preparing breakfast for her children? Or had she been one of the millions of people who didn't hear about it until later?
I was counseling a young couple, newly engaged, who were facing all the joys of their upcoming marriage. My secretary knocked on the door. She never does this. She opened the door and she was weeping. You all know Mrs. Schwab. Have you ever seen her even without a smile? The radio, she said.
Rabbi Neuberger shrugged, but somehow still conveyed all the grief that followed.
I will always think about that moment as the threshold between before and after.
He held up a finger.
If that young couple had not been in my office, I would have given way to grief. But they asked me if they should still get married. It seemed as if the world were ending. Should they marry?
He leaned forward, and you could hear the held breath of every person in the tense silence around us.
Yes. Marriage, too, is a threshold between before and after. We have many of these every day, which we do not recognize. The threshold is not the question. There will always be befores and afters. The question is, what do you do after you cross that threshold?
I wiped under my eyes with the thumb of my glove, and it came away dark with mascara.
You live. You remember. This is what our people have always done.
Outside the synagogue, bells began to sound across the city. Probably across the country, and maybe across the planet. I didn't have to look at my watch. 9:53 a.m. I closed my eyes, and even in the darkness, even 4 years later, I could still see the light. Yes, I remembered where I was when the meteor struck. I did not even make the first cut. I was consoling myself with a piece of carrot cake in the IAC cafeteria, and as a side note, let me say that the best thing about the international part of the International Aerospace Coalition was that it meant the cafeteria had a French pastry chef. But I digress. So the carrot cake and I were sitting at a table with Helen, Basira, and Myrtle. When we'd been living with Myrtle, I'd had no idea she'd worked as a computer during the war until she signed on with the IAC 2 years ago. Masira, who had come to us from Algiers, made a face.
So, then he tried to show me how to use a slide rule.
No, for a differential equation?
Myrtle, the only other American in our group, covered her mouth and laughed until her cheeks turned red.
What a buffoon!
I know.
Masira put on a terrible American accent.
Well, little lady, this here is a mighty fine instrument.
Helen had her hands clapped over her mouth and was cackling like a Taiwanese banshee, if there were such a thing.
Tell them where he hold it.
With a snort, Basira glanced around the cafeteria, but it was the end of the day shift, so it was largely empty. I lowered my fork, making a guess, and yep. She placed her hand in her lap as if the slide rule were, well, prepared for liftoff.
I can show you how to use it.
I laughed, picturing Leroy Pluckett with his wispy sideburns and loud ties trying to come on to Basira. With her height and dark, smooth complexion, she had easily won Miss Outer Space at the company holiday party last winter, plus her accent was to die for. The company of these women was a newfound joy to me. The NACA computing department had been all women, yes, but due to segregation laws in D.C., they had all been white women. If you told me 4 years ago that I was going to be one of only two white women in my group of closest friends, I would have laughed. I'm ashamed of that now. The International Aerospace Coalition, which President Brannan had convinced the UN to form, changed everything. Well, the meteor had changed everything. But having a Quaker for a president did a lot to alter hiring practices all the way down the line, and I couldn't be luckier to have these friends as a result. Helen wiped her eyes and looked over my shoulder.
Hello, Dr. York.
Good evening, ladies.
He rested his hand on my shoulder briefly in lieu of a public kiss.
What are you laughing about?
Slide rules.
Helen folded her hands demurely in her lap,
and their uses.
Which set us off again. Poor Nathaniel just watched the laughter, smiling with us, but otherwise clueless. Which reminded me that I would have to talk to him about Leroy Pluckett. It made for a funny story, but I didn't like him coming into our department and disrupting it. Technically, personnel issues were Mrs. Rogers' job, but I was the one who was sleeping with the lead engineer, so I was in a better position to fix it than the other women. Wiping my eyes and still chuckling, I slid my chair back.
Looks like my ride is here.
Are you not going to finish that cake?
Myrtle reached across the table.
It's all yours.
Nathaniel picked up my coat from the back of my chair and held it up for me. This July was almost warm enough to not need it, but not quite yet. Summer was coming, sooner than we liked. I waved goodbye to the women.
See y'all tomorrow!
A chorus of goodbyes followed us across the cafeteria amid bubbles of laughter. Nathaniel took my hand.
You seem to be in a better mood.
Well, cake helps. And getting a rose from you.
I'm glad you liked it.
He waved to one of the other engineers as we walked down the hall toward the front doors of the IAC.
I learned something today that might also cheer you up.
Oh? I stopped by the door to let him open it for me. Do tell. The late evening sun cut across the parking lot, but did little to stave off the chill air. Pulling my coat a little tighter around me, I went out and walked with Nathaniel toward the bus stop. Beyond the fence that surrounded the IAC campus, kids waited with autograph books, hoping for a glimpse of one of the astronauts. They spotted Nathaniel and once again settled for the lead engineer of the space program. I let go of his hand and stepped to the side as the kids swarmed around him. Thank heavens they had no interest in the engineer's wife. It was like watching a feeding frenzy with autograph books in lieu of teeth. He ran the gauntlet nearly every day, and I suspected that it was one of the reasons he often worked so late. Well, that and my husband's inherent nature. The kids weren't the only rocket enthusiasts. After he worked his way clear of them, Nathaniel waited until we had walked down the block toward the bus stop to get back to his news.
Well?
He glanced behind us.
This is not technically classified, since the final list of the astronauts will make it clear, but...
I won't mention anything until the final list is published. Not even the first cut. I hadn't expected to make the final team, not really. But with my logged flight time, I thought I'd at least get past the first cut.
Director Clemens did not select any women. At all.
Stopping dead in my tracks, I stared at him. The head of the IAC, Director Norman Clemens, a man I had worked with for years and someone I had respected, had not selected any women? Breath steamed in front of me as my mouth hung open. How is that supposed to make me feel better?
Well, because you know it wasn't you, right?
But there wasn't anything in the requirements about being male. Nathaniel nodded.
Clemens said he thought it would have been self-evident because of the dangers.
Oh, my God. I accepted that piece of patriarchal stupidity for test flights, but now? We're trying to establish a colony. How exactly does he expect to do that without any women?
I think...
He hesitated and looked down the street, his eyes squinted against the breeze. There were times when Nathaniel really couldn't tell me things, because they were classified, and when he hit one of those walls, he always looked vaguely constipated. Right now, it looked as if he were holding something huge. What? He licked his lips and shifted his weight.
There was some... concern about the stresses of space.
Stresses. Women handle G-forces better than men. The WASPs established that during the war and... I broke off at the sudden compression of his lips as if he were biting back words. You are kidding me. They think we'll get hysterical in space? Nathaniel shook his head and gestured toward the bus stop.
I thought we might go dancing tonight.
Grinding my teeth, I jammed my hands into my coat pockets. Why not a show while we're at it? If I had to lay money on who had objected to the fitness of women for the space program, I'd pick one man, Stetson Parker. I will grant that Nathaniel was right and that I wasn't sad anymore, but anger was perhaps not what he had intended to inspire. By the time we reached the weekend, I was still angry. If I had tried my best and failed, it would have been different. I could have dusted myself off and tried harder next time. This? This was maddening because there was nothing I could do to change it. If you haven't gathered by now, I don't do well with helpless. So I headed out to the private airfield where our local branch of the 99's Flight Club met. The first rule of Flight Club was, well, actually the first rule was safety, but after that it was ground is for griping, planes are for planning. In-air conversations did not return to the ground. Which is why I started this particular conversation on the ground. I wanted at least some gossip to arise from it. I looked around at the circle of women. When the original 99s formed, they took their name because there were only 99 women pilots in the United States. Now there were thousands of us in different clubs across the nation, and I was betting that all of us had the same ambitions. Who else applied for the astronaut corps? Everyone's hands went up, except Pearl, who was still plump from having triplets. And Helen, who didn't have her license yet. I'd gotten her hooked on flying at the 4th of July party last year. Her father still hadn't forgiven me. It was Betty's turn for pre-flight refreshments, and she had brought lemon beet cookies. I'd been dubious when they first made an appearance, but these could be made despite the sugar shortages, and they were tart, sweet, and delicious. She set the plate down on the rough wooden picnic table set up in the corner of the hangar. Her movie star red lips twisted into a pout.
I didn't make the cut.
I snatched a bright pink cookie from the plate. None of us did. The other women turned on me with expressions ranging from surprise to suspicion. Pearl wrinkled her pert little nose.
How do you know that?
Because, I broke the cookie in half, they didn't take any women.
Why? On what grounds?
Betty snorted and grabbed her bosom, which was magnificent.
Obviously, these get in the way of the controls.
Speak for yourself.
Helen ran her hands down her flight suit, which accentuated her boyish figure.
Seriously, though, I thought they were trying to establish colonies.
Nodding, I avoided any of the things Nathaniel had hinted at. They'll be doing a formal announcement of the list at a press conference next week. Betty perked up and grabbed for her bag.
You don't say.
She pulled out her reporter's notepad. I cleared my throat.
Obviously, I don't say.
But someone with a tie to a major newspaper would probably be invited and...
Nuts.
She glared at the pad.
They'll probably give it to Hart. He's getting all the prime international stuff. I swear to God, if I have to cover one more garden club.
You'll do it and be grateful for the paycheck.
Pearl twisted her gloves in her hands. Betty sighed.
You could have at least let me rant a little longer before bringing reality into this.
The thing is, I cut in, pointing my cookie at Betty. Do you think he'll notice an all-male list? She narrowed her eyes, and I could see her formulating the pitch she'd use with her editor.
Can I cite you as a source at the IAC, not by name?
I don't want to get, my source in trouble. Betty snatched the cookie out of my hand.
If you think that little of my...
I snatched it back, and crumbs went flying. Laughing, I popped the tart morsel into my mouth. I just want to make sure the parameters are clear.
Parameters confirmed.
She grabbed her flight jacket and stood.
Shall we fly?
Absolutely. I tucked another cookie into the pocket of my flight jacket and glanced at Helen. Going up with me or one of the other girls?
Wouldn't miss it.
My little Cessna 170B could carry four people. Betty had a Texan, but it wasn't any good for conversation. So she decided that, given the topic, she'd start with us so we didn't have to use the radio to talk. We piled into the cockpit and put the conversation on hold while I went through the pre-flight checklist. There is something magic about takeoffs. I know people who are afraid of flying who say that the takeoffs and landings are the only hard parts. Perhaps because that's when the act of flying is most apparent. I love the way you get pushed back into your seat. The weight and the sense of momentum press against you, and the vibrations from the tarmac hum through the yoke and into your palms and legs. Then suddenly, everything stops and the ground drops away. It never feels like I'm rising, but that the ground is falling away from me as if I were light as air. Maybe that's what frightens people. Or maybe I'm not frightened because my dad flew with the Air Force when it was still part of the Army and had taken me on my first plane ride when I was 2 years old. I'm told that I laughed the entire flight. Clearly, I don't remember that. I do remember begging him to do barrel rolls when I got a little older. Most kids, their dad teaches them to drive. Mine taught me to fly. Anyway, once we were up in the air... I turned us in a lazy spiral away from the airfield just to get a feel for the air today. Betty sat in the co-pilot seat with Helen behind us. Betty turned to address both of us, shouting a little over the engine.
All right. Flight Club rules are in effect. Am I right that they want to turn the moon into a military base?
From all the things Nathaniel isn't saying, I think it's actually that women are too emotional to go into space. Betty shook her head, and I'm fairly certain she cursed under the sound of the airplane.
Right. This is Hog Swallow, and we need to change it.
How? Helen leaned forward in her seat.
I can pitch this to my editor as discrimination, but that's not going to take if I can't also talk about some of the women who were passed over.
She looked at me.
I can do it in ways that won't make my sources clear, And I can also prime Hart to ask the question and bring it front and center at the press conference.
I glanced sideways at her.
How? I mean, that feels very direct.
Mr. President, with an all-male astronaut corps, is there a danger that the communist bloc will perceive this as a military outpost rather than a colony?
Helen raised her hand as if to remind us that she was from Taiwan.
He'll counter with international cooperation.
I nodded.
We've got people at the IAC from Taiwan, Algeria, Spain, Brazil, France, Germany, Serbia, Haiti, the Congo.
Helen chimed in.
Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, the United Kingdom,
and the U.S. Betty shook her head.
And none of those are communist countries.
Okay, but it still doesn't talk about the hysteria aspect.
No, but it does highlight the all-male astronaut corps, and that gives us leverage for a follow-up about why there are no women.
She snorted.
And it's an election year. Eisenhower is running against Brennan, so I'm going to bet money right now that a return to normalcy with women relegated back to being homemakers is going to be a key election issue.
Cold ran all the way to the center of my body.
But the director of the IAC doesn't answer to the president. He...
Even as the words left my mouth, I knew I was being stupid. The IAC might be an international effort, but because the launch center was on American soil, we had more influence on the program than other countries, even with a British director. And I'd seen the list of astronauts. Fully three-quarters of them were American or British. All of them were white.
Everyone buckled up?
They both said yes, but didn't ask me why. They knew me well. I pulled the plane up, gaining altitude, and looped us over. Centrifugal force kept us pushed into our seats. The earth lay spread out below in a quilt of green and brown. There was enough haze in the sky that the line between ground and air was indistinct, and the edges blurred away into the silver white of the sky. I'd seen pictures from orbit. The earth turned into a blue-green globe. I wanted to float weightless in space and see the stars with all their startling clarity. If these men, with their constant jockeying for dominance, dragged us back into the dark ages, I would... What? Bringing the plane out of the loop, I took us into a barrel roll. Silver and green spun about, with us as the center of the pinwheel. Behind me, Helen laughed and clapped her hands. Coming out of the roll, I considered my next option. People were losing sight of the greenhouse timeline, since this was a slow disaster. We needed to establish colonies on the moon and the other planets while we had the resources to spare. If their excuse was that establishing a colony wasn't safe for women, then we'd need to prove that women were just as capable as men.
Do you think your newspaper would be interested in covering an all-women air show?
Hell yes.
Betty jabbed her finger at me.
But only if I get to use your name.
I'm not anyone.
You're married to the lead engineer at the IAC. That story about you flying out after the meteor, I can use that.
I swallowed. Being the center of attention was necessary. And it would just be talking to Betty.
Sure, you can do that.
12.
Men of the Space Age. National Times photographs by Sam Falk. March 26, 1956. The rocket specialists, those who think up, design, engineer, and fire the mighty engines to carry scientific instruments aloft, are the men to whom the country looks for achievement in the space age. They work in many fields, ranging from fuels to computer systems and from alloys to communication techniques. The best known of these is Dr. Nathaniel York, who is the lead engineer for the International Aerospace Coalition.
The press conference went exactly as Betty predicted. When questioned about the exclusively male list, Norman Clemens, the director of the IAC, said that it was for safety considerations, and it was much the same as when Columbus discovered the New World, or Shackleton's trip to the North Pole. No one had been concerned that there were no women on those expeditions.
He was sure that the international effort made it clear that this was entirely a peaceful scientific expedition. Some of the women's magazines, which had been founded to agitate for suffrage, picked up Betty's story and joined her in rallying for women to be included in founding the colony. No men paid any attention to the women's magazines. I know, shocking. Masira sat down on the opposite side of our shared desk at the IAC.
He's back.
I glanced around to see if anyone had heard her. Not that it really mattered, but the other women in the computing department were all busy at their calculations. The scratching of pencils across paper and the shush of glass cursors brushing over Bakelite slide rules were punctuated by the rattle of our Frieden mechanical calculator. And even if anyone had been paying attention, there was nothing wrong with Basira reporting that Director Clemens had returned from the testing range. Besides, most of them knew what I was hoping to do. I nodded and closed my notebook. I set it to the side of my desk, pencil lined up neatly against it. Opening my desk drawer, I pulled out another notebook labeled Wasps, which had the figures I'd collated about the women Air Force service pilots of the Second World War. Standing, I hugged the notebook to my chest. Masira smiled at me.
Operation Ladies First is go.
I needed the laughter rather desperately. Helen glanced up from the desk she shared with Myrtle. She nudged Myrtle, who turned and gave me a thumbs up. Nodding to them, I headed out of the room and down the corridors to Director Clemens' office. There was no reason to be afraid of him. We'd enjoyed multiple conversations at holiday parties or company picnics. He was always a calming presence in the dark room on launch days. But before, Nathaniel or my work had always been there as a shield. My palms left damp imprints on the cover of my notebook. I stopped before I got to Clemens's office door, which was always open, to wipe my hands on my skirt. Today, I'd opted for a simple gray pencil skirt and a white blouse, which I hoped made me look more businesslike. Any type of armor would be welcomed. Swallowing, I went to the door, and Mrs. Kerr, his secretary, looked up with a smile.
Mrs. York, what can I do for you?
I was hoping I could make an appointment to speak with Director Clemens. This was me chickening out. I had the notebook, and he was right there. He was reading with his feet up on the desk, one of his cigars clenched between his teeth. Smoke belched around him like a misfiring engine. The book he held had a rocket in front of a dusty red landscape on the cover, and looked more like a novel than a technical paper.
Let me check his schedule.
He lowered the book.
Send her on in.
Oh. I swallowed. Something about his crisp British diction always made me feel as if I'd come in unwashed from a field. Thank you, sir. He held up the book as I approached his desk.
Have you had the opportunity to read this yet?
No, sir.
It has a Captain York in it who sounds remarkably like your husband.
He gestured toward a chair.
Sit. Have you ever met this Bradbury chap?
No, sir.
Well, I think you must be a fan. The notion of an ancient civilization on Mars is rubbish, but I will happily accept any press that excites people about space.
He set the book on his desk.
The American Congress is getting huffy about appropriations again. Is that what you're here for? Do you need another one of the IBMs for the computing department? They are offering.
I shook my head. That's really Mrs. Rogers' decision, but for myself, well, they aren't very reliable.
So the engineers keep telling me. Overheating.
He grunted, nodding.
What brings you here?
Oh, well, it's actually about keeping people excited about Mars, sir. You see, I wanted to talk to you about considering women for future missions.
Women?
He sat forward and gave me his full focus.
No. If we want people to be excited, we need the most highly qualified pilots on these missions, or the public will have our heads.
I understand. But if we want to establish viable colonies, they'll need families, and that means convincing women that it's safe. I opened my notebook to the chart of statistics I had drawn up. Now, certainly you don't want to send the average woman into space any more than the average man would be a good candidate. But as an example, I thought that maybe you might consider some of the WASP pilots.
There were 1,027 women who flew during the war for the United States alone, and they averaged 700 flight hours each, with 792 of them going well over 1,000 flight hours. The average fighter pilot, on the other hand...
No.
I beg your pardon?
I am not sending women into space. If a man does, well, that's tragic, but people will accept that. A woman? No. The program would be shut down in its entirety.
I stood, putting the notebook on his table and spinning it so he could see. I think we could shift public perception, though. With these numbers...
No. We're speaking of women who ferried planes around as if they fought in combat.
Pressing my hands against the comforting grid lines, I took another breath. He had said combat as if that was a consideration for the space missions, but you wouldn't need that on a colony. I chickened out, the way I always do, and didn't call him on that slip. We're doing an air show. Maybe you could come out and see it? As an example of how we could shift perception of women pilots. The amount of training the WASPs had to go through was more rigorous than the men because of the variety of planes that we flew.
I appreciate your efforts, but I have to keep this project running. I do not have time for charity work.
He picked up the novel again and started to read.
Good afternoon, Mrs. York.
I closed the notebook and bit down hard on the inside of my lip. I couldn't tell you if I was trying to keep from yelling or crying. Probably both. The weeks marched on and my attention was pulled away from the idea of an air show, partially from despair, but mostly because the IAC was working nonstop toward a lunar landing. While the American branch was doing that, our European counterparts were preparing to establish an orbiting space station. Teletypes flew back and forth across the Atlantic as the rocket scientists shared notes. We were all pulling long hours. Still, Nathaniel and I tried to leave before sundown on Fridays so we could observe Sabbath. Not that either of us was especially observant, but it was good discipline. I leaned on the doorframe to his office as the heavy gray shadows of evening dulled the parking lot outside. Nathaniel had his shirt sleeves rolled up and was glaring at something on his desk. With one knuckle, I rapped on the inner office door. Ready to go?
Hmm?
He looked up and rubbed his eyes.
I've got a little more to do. Mind waiting?
You know, you'd think that we'd do a better job of leaving by sundown in the summer. Nathaniel spun in his chair to face the parking lot.
What time is it?
Almost 9. I came into his office and set my purse and coat down on one of the chairs. Did you take a break today?
Yeah, I had a lunch meeting with Clemens.
He turned back to the desk and picked up the paper he'd been studying.
Elma, if you were in orbit, would an R-bar or a V-bar rendezvous make more sense to you?
Okay, first of all, a lunch meeting does not count as taking a break. I leaned over the back of his chair so I could see the paper he was so fixed on. It was a report called Line of Sight Guidance Techniques for Manned Orbital Rendezvous, which seemed to consist of more questions than answers. Second, what's the assumed orbit? He flipped through the pages.
Hang on. Let's say 4,000 miles.
Putting my hands on the base of his neck, I dug my thumbs in while I considered the question. One of the challenges of orbital mechanics was that the faster you went, the higher you orbited, and thus the slower the orbit. It was completely counterintuitive without equations or a model. So my instinct as a pilot to do the V-bar rendezvous couldn't be trusted. The V-bar rendezvous got its V from velocity, which you used to catch up to the target by flying in the same direction that it was speeding. I dug my finger into the muscles that ran up the back of Nathaniel's neck. His head dropped forward until his chin rested on his chest. But an R-bar rendezvous might work. If we dropped into a lower orbit than our target... That would make the ship move faster than the target, and we'd catch up with it. Once close enough, we could just fire thrusters to push back up toward the target, which should use less fuel. I had a possible answer, but given the little grunts of pleasure that my husband was making, I wasn't entirely sure he would hear me. His trapezius was a solid mass of knots down to between his shoulder blades. I'd lean toward an R-bar rendezvous. Less fuel, plus the orbital mechanics mean there would be natural braking action if the thrusters failed. Lifting his head, he leaned forward to stare at the page.
See, that's what I thought, but Parker wants V-bar.
My hands paused and then smoothed out his dress shirt. Well, he's been in space and I haven't. As a pilot, I'd probably give his opinion more weight than mine.
That's part of my problem. Everyone gives his opinion more weight because he's one of the original Artemis Seven.
He threw the paper back on the table.
Even on things that have nothing to do with piloting. I mean, he's still going on about the Soviet, excuse me, the communist threat.
The long winter hit them harder than us. The Soviet Union dissolved, for crying out loud. What's he thinking? Nathaniel rubbed his forehead.
The Soviet Union is gone, but Russia is as big as ever.
And starving. The long winter had affected the nations closer to the poles more than others. China isn't in any better condition.
I think he's trying to curry favor with Eisenhower by trying to, I don't know. And I'm totally talking out of school.
With the elections, people were starting to lose sight of the reason for getting into space. At least they weren't dismissing the importance of a space program. Yet. It's not always Nathaniel who keeps us late at the office. The next Monday, I got caught up in a series of equations for translunar trajectories. It was fascinating because I was trying to account for the shift in gravitational pull as the spacecraft transitioned from the Earth's sphere of influence to the moon's. It affected everything, including the amount of propellant required. By the time Nathaniel and I got back to our tiny apartment, I had a head full of porridge. Throwing the day's mail on the table, I dropped into the closest chair. My fingers were smudged with ink, but I still rested my head on my hands with a sigh. Space sounded so romantic. Nathaniel chuckled dryly behind me and bent down to kiss the back of my neck.
I thought I wasn't going to be able to pry you out of the office tonight.
Well, Sanchez needs the propellant calculations by tomorrow so he can adjust the payload parameters. I massaged my temples, trying to ease some of the strain from staring at numbers all day. Becky was working on it, but then someone told Director Clemens that she was pregnant, and she was just barely showing. It's not like we do anything but sit at a desk.
And run back and forth to the labs, and sit in on tests where we're firing experimental engines, and propellant tests, and...
You are just as bad! I straightened and glared at him. He was leaning against the kitchenette's counter with his coat off and his tie half undone.
Oh, no. No. I would have let her keep working, but maybe kept her out of the test sites. But I understand why the director made the call he did.
Because, and I quote, pregnancy has a direct effect on women's brains? He snorted.
Politician, not a scientist. If something happened to a pregnant woman working at the IAC, it would set back public relations.
I opened my mouth to retort and snapped it shut. He was right, darn it. People were already trying to shift funding from the space program because they couldn't grasp the scale of the disaster that was coming. Turning back to the table, I picked up an envelope. I'm going to go through the mail.
You can pay the bills tomorrow.
I won't be any less tired. Part of our marriage agreement was that I handled the bills and balanced the checkbook. We were both good at math, conceptually, but I could do it in my head. Nathaniel needed to write things down, which meant I was faster. Behind me, a cabinet opened, followed by the rattle of crockery.
Baked potatoes and... we have a little bit of ground beef. Chili sound good?
Yes, yes, I have a husband who cooks. He does not have a wide array of dishes, but the ones he does know how to prepare work well with our ration books. The chili would be mostly beans, but tasty. That would be welcome. There was a letter from Herschel, which I put aside to answer over the weekend. If I tried now, he'd get nothing but a string of numbers and symbols. Electric bill, phone bill, those went in another stack to pay tonight. A heavy white envelope, which fairly screamed invitation, caught my eye. We got a lot of those from different people wanting to have THE Dr. York at their soiree. He was front and center at every press conference explaining trajectories and mission parameters in ways that anyone could understand. Doing the same thing at a dinner party was just tiring. But this invitation had Senator Wargan's return address. I knew his wife. Nicole Wargan had been a pilot with the WASPs during the war, and Senator Wargan was a vocal supporter of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. I was hoping that the combination of his progressive politics and his wife's interests would make him sympathetic to my own hobby horse. I opened the envelope, sliding out the heavy white card.
Senator and Mrs. Kenneth T. Wargan request the pleasure of Dr. and Mrs. York's company at a dinner party at 6:30 on the 7th of August.
Nathaniel? I turned in my chair. He had his shirt sleeves rolled up and was rubbing a potato with oil.
Hmm?
Senator Wargan and his wife have invited us to a dinner on the 7th. Shall I say yes? He shook his head, setting the potato on the counter.
That's only a week before the next launch. I'll be exhausted.
I stood and leaned against the counter next to him. That's your natural state.
Yours too.
He grabbed the other potato and rubbed oil over its surface. The muscles in his forearms rippled with the motion. Oil had splashed just above his left wrist and glistened with each movement. True. I set my finger in the streak of oil and drew it farther up the inside of his arm. This way someone else will cook dinner for us.
And I'll have to make witty conversation.
Oh, no. No one expects witty from you. He laughed and leaned down to kiss me.
Why this one?
I used to fly with Nicole Wargan. I slipped around to stand behind Nathaniel. Running my hands around his ribcage, I leaned into him. And I'm hoping that the senator might have thoughts about the need for women in the colony.
Aha.
He turned in my arms, still holding the potato. Keeping his oily hands away from my clothes, he kissed me on the cheek, then at the base of my jaw, then nibbled a trail down my neck. Between gasps, I managed to squeak out, "And you could use the same time to argue for the need to get off planet."
Well, I'm still going to be exhausted.
I could make it worth your while.
These potatoes still need to go into the oven.
Laughing, I released my hold on his waist and stepped back. Fine. Far be it from me to distract you. He bent down to open the oven door, giving me a look at his well-tailored trousers. Have I mentioned recently how fortunate I am to be married to Nathaniel? The warm air from the oven stirred a strand of his hair, and the light caught on that glinting oil again as he set both potatoes directly on the wire rack. He stood and kicked the oven door closed with his heel. The heat from the oven seemed to warm the entire apartment. Nathaniel lifted a hand still glossy with oil.
I figure.
He traced a line down my throat.
It'll take about an hour before those are ready.
Is that so? My breathing was fast and heated. Do I have time to make my argument for going to the dinner party? His finger continued its path, gliding along the collar of my shirt until he reached the top button.
As long as I get to make an argument for staying in.
Counter-argument confirmed. 13.
Space record set by Le Bourgeois. Colonies in space would aid humanity. By Henry Tanner, special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, Saturday, April 13th, 1956. Lieutenant Colonel Jean-Paul Le Bourgeois has given the International Aerospace Coalition another space record by staying in orbit more than 4 days. With this advancement, the IAC has demonstrated that working and sleeping in space is possible, a necessary step for the space program.
Nicole Wargan perched on the arm of the sofa in her living room, her glass filled with pre-meteor champagne. The diamonds around her throat glittered above a glorious peacock green dress. Around us, the living room was filled with the cream of society in tuxedos and rich jewel-toned evening gowns, enjoying the kind of food that a ration book wouldn't get you. If you couldn't hear what Nicole was saying, she might have been any society maven. Thank God she was more interesting than that.
So the mechanic had sworn that the Hellcat was flightworthy, but I was at 6,000 feet and my fuel gauge suddenly bottomed out.
Over the ocean?
Mrs. Heber clasped a hand over her bosom in dismay. Earlier, she had regaled us with stories of how she'd saved her prize roses from the meteor winter through heroic use of glass and steam. Too bad she wasn't interested in growing vegetables. I'd saved us by prompting Nicole to tell war stories. That I had another agenda was beside the point. At the moment, we weren't hearing about aphid invasions. I'd heard Nicole's story before, so I just sipped my cocktail and enjoyed the show as Nicole pointed a manicured nail at her.
Yes, over the ocean. Well, I hadn't any other choice, had I, but to circle back to the aircraft carrier and tell them I was coming in. No, without an engine. It was that or land in the ocean. When I landed, it turned out that the mechanic had missed a damaged fuel line. You should have heard the chief tear him up and down.
Unpowered landings were part of training, but landing on an aircraft carrier was a whole other ball of wax. She caught my eye and gave a wink.
Tell them about the Messerschmitt, Zelma.
I had been perfectly content to sit among the other women and listen to Nicole tell stories, but when your hostess invites you to take the floor...
Oh, well,
we weren't supposed to be flying combat missions because it was too dangerous for women. Nicole snorted and shook her head.
Not that the Germans could tell who was flying a plane.
Exactly. So I was delivering a Mustang to the Ambérieu-en-Bugey airbase, and a trio of Messerschmitts comes up out of nowhere.
The crowd around us had gained a few men, which I'd been hoping the topic would draw, but still, there were suddenly a lot of people listening to me. I took a sip of my champagne. Bear in mind that I was flying a fighter plane, but it didn't have any ammunition.
Oh, no.
That came from Senator Wargan, who had joined his wife. He was a stout man who carried the weight well, beneath a full head of hair that was just beginning to gray.
Oh, yes. I had just enough time to radio for help, and then they started firing. All I could do was evade and hope to outmaneuver them. And, of course, the day was utterly cloudless. But there's this river valley that runs toward the base, and I thought that maybe I could find some cover there.
Nicole leaned forward.
Which comes with its own set of problems, because you're flying low and there's no room for mistakes.
But it was better than being shot at. So I'm tearing down the valley with this damp, dratted German on my tail and another one flying cover for him.
I tried to demonstrate where the other planes were in relation to me without spilling my drink. I have no idea where the third is. All I'm trying to do is use the river bends to make sure they can never get a straight shot at me and praying that our boys are going to find me in time.
And clearly they did.
Ah, the sound of smug masculinity. I turned in my chair. Actually, Colonel Parker, they didn't. Of course he'd been invited to the dinner. Senator Wargan was excited about the space program, so naturally he would want the first man in space there as another trophy guest, like Nathaniel. Nicole laughed at the look of shock on Parker's face.
She got one of them to shoot the other, flew the second into a cliff, and what happened to the third?
I never saw him again. I'm assuming that when our boys did arrive, they chased him off.
Wait.
Parker held up his hand.
You're telling me you downed two Messerschmitts without ammunition?
The nice thing about anger is that it overrides my anxiety about being the center of attention. I had the advantage of knowing the terrain. I'd been ferrying planes in for months and knew where the river forked. They clearly didn't.
I don't believe it. Are you calling my wife a liar?
Nathaniel does this thing with his voice when he's angry that always reminds me of my father. It gets very low and very controlled. Right now it was so tense you could have stabilized a rocket with it. He stood just behind me, only a few feet from Parker.
No, no, of course not, Dr. York. I just wondered if it was really a Messerschmitt.
He smiled charmingly and winked at Senator Wargan.
You know how excited ladies can get. One plane becomes three, a biplane becomes a Messerschmitt. Maybe the sun was in her eyes on this utterly cloudless day. I'm sure she's not lying, but maybe a little confused. That's all.
I set my glass down on the nearest table so I didn't crack the stem in my fist. Oh, Colonel Parker, you're so clever. Why, that must be just what happened.
Laying my hand on my bosom, I turned to Nicole.
Don't you think?
She joined me, like the world's best wingman.
I'm sure you're right. And to think all these years we've been confused by the wreckage. Why, that prisoner must have lied about what kind of plane he was flying to make himself look good.
I declare... I think you're right.
Turning back to Colonel Parker, I beamed up at him.
Thank you ever so much for straightening that out for me. I feel like such a fool.
Perhaps that was a tactical error. His face had red blotches at the cheeks, and it wasn't from embarrassment. He inclined his head.
Still, the danger you were placed in demonstrates why letting women near a combat zone was a mistake.
I'm curious, Colonel Parker. How would you have handled being unarmed? As a man.
Tactical mistake or no, this got right to the heart of the astronaut issue. He held up his hands.
Look, you were clearly very fortunate. I'm just saying that you should never have been put in that position.
I agree. My plane should have been armed. As a woman, I'm smaller and lighter. That means that my plane needs less fuel, and I handle G-forces better than a man. That last was skirting the truth, because I was tall for a woman, and the ability to handle G-forces was more related to height and blood pressure. In fact, I would argue that women should already be in the astronaut corps for exactly those reasons, to say nothing of the fact that we're trying to establish a colony.
And men are better suited to do that work.
He glanced around the room and parroted what Clemens had said during the press conference.
Christopher Columbus didn't take any women on his voyage, did he?
That was about conquest. Sweat beaded under my brassiere. The pilgrims, on the other hand, did bring women. If you want to establish a colony, we need women in space.
I see no compelling reason for that.
Here's a reason. Nicole laughed, lifting her glass over her head.
Babies!
Laughter bubbled around us, breaking the tension. Senator Wargan stepped forward and guided Parker away, chatting amiably about golf. Small kindnesses sometimes are the best ones. Nicole left her perch and came to join Nathaniel and me. Standing, I picked up my glass and saluted her with it. Sorry about that.
Please, I remember Grabby Parker from the war.
She took a sip of her champagne.
Have you met his wife?
I shook my head. Oh, we don't socialize.
You'll notice that she's not here tonight. Not that I'm saying anything by that. I'm just noting that Mrs. Parker was invited.
Speaking of invitations, I glanced at Nathaniel, who seemed content to stay with me rather than mingle. I'm putting together an air show featuring women pilots. I don't suppose...
Yes, if you're about to ask me to fly, yes.
She held up her hand, diamond bracelet glittering.
Wait, darn it. I need to check with Kenneth to be certain it's okay, politics and all. But I can usually talk him round. So if there's no conflict, then yes. Might be confused, my Aunt Fanny.
Swell. That would delight Betty's journalistic soul. Having a senator's wife on our roster would make pitching an article about the air show to her editor at the National Times that much easier. And, as an added bonus, it meant I wouldn't have to be front and center. Surprising amount of time in concrete bunkers. The smell of kerosene filled the air of the testing range, even in the control bunker. Having the test range 3 miles away from 203,400 gallons of kerosene still seemed uncomfortably close. I rolled a pencil between my fingers, waiting for the static firing test of the new Atlas rocket. This one was an easy assignment. All I had to do was calculate the amount of thrust and see if it would be enough to get a rocket into orbit. Any of the computers could have done it, but I was here because it was Leroy Pluckett's project. Damn good engineer. Couldn't keep his hands off the computers. But as his boss's wife, I had very few problems with him. Relatively few. He leaned over my chair, one hand sliding across my shoulders to rest on the chair back.
How's it going, Elma?
I sat forward so he wasn't touching me. Can't do much until it fires. Across the room, one of the other engineers lifted his head.
Dr. Pluckett, we're adding the liquid oxygen now.
Great.
He smiled down at me, and by me, I mean my bosom.
Just let me know if you need anything.
Absolutely. I tapped my pencil on the table, trying to draw his eyes away. I should probably finish getting ready.
Can I help with...
An explosion rocked the room. Sound and heat roared through the bunker, carrying the stench of burning carbons. It wasn't the first time we'd lost a rocket by any stretch, but that didn't make it any quieter. Engineers flinched, throwing their hands up to plug their ears. I twitched away and nearly fell out of my chair as the thunder died, leaving just the distant crackle of a fire. Sirens joined the cacophony. Pluckett reached for me as if he were trying to help, only his meaty hand somehow landed on my chest. Standing, I straightened my skirt and stepped back from him. My pulse shook through my hands as much from anger at Pluckett as from the explosion.
You'd best attend to your rocket, or do you need me to calculate the size of the misfire?
The weight of the bowling ball pressed against my palm as I stared down the lane. Letting out a breath, I advanced, swinging back, forward, and releasing the ball. It left my hand in a momentarily perfect line, then curved to the side to hit just off center.
A split. Darn it. Again.
You can do it, Elma!
Behind me, Myrtle clapped her hands.
You can do it!
I spun back, skirt flaring around me while I waited for the pin boy to clear the ones I had knocked down.
You'd think that a physicist would be better at this.
With an arm around his wife, Eugene shook his head.
Theory and practice, two different things. It's like saying being a physicist should allow you to fly.
I can fly, thank you very much. My bowling ball thunked against the end of the return trough, and I stooped to pick it up, waving a little thank you to the pin boy who'd rolled it back. We had to remember to tip them well.
Speaking of flying,
Eugene said. Myrtle nudged his foot.
Let her bowl. I want to see the fireworks. We'll get you out in time to enjoy the Fourth.
Eugene shook his head and pointed his beard toward the lane.
And I'll wait till after Elma's turn for my...